Okay,
Yes,
so the
please
last
do.
time we spoke, all right, so
Go
in
ahead, Brian. Yep.
the first iteration of this talk that I gave, I sort of explained why I think Russia is our enemy. I'm just a brief recap of the last talk I gave, that there is indisputable evidence that was corroborated by Trump's own national intelligence agencies that Russia interfered in our 2016 national elections, that Russia over the past 20 years has carried out 20 years of cyber attacks against our pipelines and our banks, and I went into great detail the last time about talking about why a violation of our electoral process is actually a declaration of war against the people, because it's an invasion of our sovereign and autonomous, the autonomous and sovereign sphere, which within which we make our decisions and shape our destinies and the laws that play an influence in shaping our destiny. And I outlined why Russia had to be punished. So I'm operating on the premise, and I will talk a little bit more about that, that Russia has already declared war against America, interfering in our national elections by a series of cyber attacks that it has carried out over the past 20 years against our institutions, industrial and financial institutions. That the only reason, I suppose, America has not acknowledged the fact that Russia has declared war on us is out of political expediency. So, what I want to talk a little bit about today is the idea of this new liberal world order that emerged after World War II, of which America was the main architect, and why it's really important to keep that liberal world order in place as a way of maintaining both American power and American supremacy, given the fact that I do think indisputably that Russia already has declared war on America, on American institutions. Why the maintenance of this world order is even now more important today, or as important today as it certainly was back in 1943, 45. So, as Roosevelt stated in 1943, after those proposals were drawn up for a post-war network in the Pacific and Atlantic, he said, quote, "If the USA did not pull the fangs of the predatory animals of this world, they would multiply and grow in strength and would be at our throats once more in a short generation." Close quote. So the New World Order was designed to disallow or to prevent a sort of a return to a state of affairs that produced two world wars, and a state of affairs that threatened American, not just American supremacy, but American democratic values and the American capitalist system. So America is not safe in a world where Europe is threatened by even one hostile autocratic power, I believe. And it is in our national self-interest, I believe, to defeat Russia, because part of its manifest destiny is to undermine American democracy and to also undermine democracies around the world. That's part of what Russia does as its manifest destiny. I gave a talk on Clubhouse several months ago about what a new manifest destiny on America's part would look like, which is the topic of my next book. It's a 700-page book on American foreign policy, the normative implications of what an ethical foreign policy would look like. Unlike a lot of objectivists, I do believe that foreign policy is a philosophical issue, and I do make that case in that forthcoming book. So it is in our national self-interest to defeat Russia, because part of its manifest destiny is to undermine our democracy. Furthermore, I argue that I would say that the architectural security of Europe is linked, inextricably linked, to our national self-interest, right? So we are co-imbricated, I think, in a nexus of causal relationships. And we saw this after 9/11, how the shared intelligence among the nations helped us to expedite a series of security networks in place that were very, very, very efficient. So if the architectural security of Europe or any of our allies really is threatened, our national self-interest is also threatened because of our co-imbrication in what I would call a nexus of causal relationships. So if Putin's global manifest destiny of undermining democracies around the world goes unchecked, I think Rob, in his really, really enlightening and great debate with Richard, talked about a Hobbesian international state of nature. I completely agree with that, that if left unchecked, it creates a Hobbesian international anarchical state of nature. I mean, the global sphere is already an anarchical state of nature since there's no supranational or transnational bodies to really govern it. We have international law, we have the International Court of Justice, and we have the International World Court, and we have these norms and protocols, but there's no really overarching enforcing agency to enforce these codified protocols and norms and laws. So an anarchical state of nature, which compromises America's, I would say, ability to navigate itself in the world on the economic front, to say nothing of the matter of shared intelligence, is pretty scary because we are not as independent as we think we are. I think as Eli Lake points out in a recent article, I believe it was in Commentary, if my memory serves me correctly, he says that Russia and China and other dictatorships actually abuse Interpol's system for alerting the world about criminal fugitives, that they go about issuing red notices for their opponents while they harbor hackers and arms dealers and other thugs. So Russia really is a threat to the community of nations. And we are in a cold war with a country whose capital is in Moscow. So Russia is a sinkhole. It's a sinkhole country. Politically, it's a sinkhole. It's a both a reverted state and an inverted state. And it's a drainage system that I think brings down the civilizational quality of the continent. And the effect on our allies will be, I think, indescribable, right? It's a sort of ecological political ballast, like any rogue state certainly is. And I think moral political rogue states remove the possibility of a lasting peace by, in some sense, subjugating human beings in the global commons to continuous fear by exposing them directly to the threat of war, by compromising or destroying those institutions that are devoted to keeping a peaceful world order and a balance of power among the what I call in my book, the union of moral nations and states devoted to peaceful international relations. And also by inflicting brutality and opposition or oppression, really, against their own people. So I'm going to, this might rankle some people, but one of my, you know, heroes is the former secretary, I think he was the 51st Secretary of State, Dean Acheson, stated the situation very clearly. He said that, you know, we live in the middle of an increasingly connected, interconnected world. And we would be invariably dragged into conflicts, whether we wish to be or not. And our interests, therefore, broadly speaking, involves keeping Europe safe by extending our security frontier many, many miles, thousands of miles away from our shores into areas where threats are likely to emerge. So in one sense, our grand strategy in creating the new liberal international world order after World War II was, and I think still remains, one that speaks to being proactive and not just being passive. So I would say, yes, that our role as a leader is to shape international environment and not just to passively react to it, because there are just too many egregious and nefarious manifest destinies out there in the world. It is not in our national self-interest to have Russia partner with Iran. I spoke about that the last time in some detail. And it is not in our national self-interest to have Russia use its veto at the UN Security Council to protect its Syrian ally, right, which it did in 2013. So as Acheson says, in the world as it's constituted back in 1945 when he made the statement, the only guarantee of peace was the continued moral, military, and economic power of the United States. And he described the United States as the locomotive at the head of mankind, which I agree with that. So the sort of liberal progress that has been made in Europe, and again, you know, the civilized countries in Europe, most of the countries in Europe, I would say, are civilized. Most of, at least the ones that are we're allied with, require the liberal progress require that the U.S. continue to back this international order, and to exercise power that includes, you know, broad spheres of influence, really broad spheres of influence. So our responsibility as a world power, if we were to remain one, requires maintaining a global, let me just say it outright, it requires maintaining global law and order, because an anarchical Hobbesian state of nature is a state that is inimical to American national self-interest on all fronts. And I think that Russia presents such a threat. This idea that NATO and an expansive NATO eastward, or either the existence of NATO or the expansion of NATO eastward, is what has caused or has contributed to the ire or the wrath or the anger of Putin, I think is untrue. Putin has gone on record and stated that he does not in any way consider the boundaries drawn after World War II as legitimate, that is the carving up of into the Soviet Union, and he does not respect the boundaries before World War II as legitimate, which speaks to the idea that really what he wants to do is reconstitute a massive Russian Empire. So the notion that Putin would be our friend if we either withdrew from NATO, neutralized NATO, or if NATO hadn't existed at all, is, I think, a bunch of malarkey. So in the end, I think that no authoritarian or despotic regime will or can remain the friend of America any more than a thug, a criminal, or a thief can be friends with an honest and a good person, because the differences in fundamental values will inevitably drive an irreconcilable wedge between the two sources. So, you know, the question is, what can we do? Well, I spoke at length last 2 weeks ago about some of the measures that we could take, some of which included making sure that increase the sanctions doubly, banning Russia, of course, keep banning Russia from Russian banks, from SWIFT, from the Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunications, and crippling its ability to trade with most of the world. I would add some other things too. I would say that in some sense we work on, and this is probably quite contentious, but we work on expelling Russia from the UN or the Security Council. And I think I'm going to agree with Eli Lake when he says that the Western nations should promote the idea, really, of demoting Russia's status, speaking about the UN, that Western diplomats should really explore the prospect of demoting Russia's status on the grounds that there was no General Assembly vote for Russia to join the UN after the collapse of the Soviet Union, right? There was just no General Assembly vote for Russia to join the UN. If that doesn't work, we should issue an ultimatum. It's Russia or us, and the US cannot or will not demote Russia's status, and the West, led by America, should undertake to build an alternative to the United Nations that excludes Russia and eventually China. I mean, I wholeheartedly have a two chapters on why Russia and China should be expelled from the UN and strategic law to go about doing this. I also think that if Russia continues surreptitiously and not so surreptitiously with its attacks, cyber attacks, we continue with counter cyber attacks, that we continue to arm Ukraine to the maximum. And I think just today, I just pulled it off of the internet, that the US and its allies are now shipping, I think this was published in the Wall Street Journal today, large volumes of very heavy weaponry to Ukraine, including much more advanced Western systems to supplement the sort of light weapons that the that were being supplied during the Soviet era arms, the Soviet weaponry that were being funneled into Ukraine. And Biden has asked for $33 billion more to fund weaponry to the Ukraine. I think that is perfectly legitimate. I would also there have been volunteers that have been contracted, we can call them contracted mercenaries from private companies or any voluntary set of troops that would like to go to the Ukraine. They should be amassed at the border, at every section of the Ukrainian border. And also that we should be using our embassies in ways that can sort of as monitoring agencies or embassies as monitoring agencies to keep abreast of freedom movements inside of Russia and support them in any way possible. This is a point that I think Lake touched on and I have written on before, to use our embassies as these agencies to monitor freedom movements inside Russia and to support them in any way that we can that would undermine Putin's efficacy and his capacity to rule. There is one other point that I made last week that I wanted to just reiterate, and that is the fact that Russia views not just NATO, but he views the USA and the West as his enemies. So this idea that somehow Russia can be brought within the pantheon of moral nations and be made a friend is just not the case. Russia has threatened the US several times, or Putin has threatened the US several times, and has now threatened two of our allies, Finland and Sweden, who have remained neutral but have applied for membership or seem to be on the verge of applying for membership into NATO. The idea also that NATO is a threat to Russia has to be challenged in the sense that NATO has never threatened Russia. Okay, NATO has never threatened Russia. Even during the Cold War period, it was just a defensive alliance, and it was configured in such a way for defense, while everybody knows those of the Warsaw Pact were the opposite. So Russia would have no fear of NATO were it not a rogue nation. Sweden doesn't fear NATO. Moral nations don't fear NATO. Russia has good reasons for fearing NATO because it's a belligerent sinkhole rogue nation. There's so much to say, but I've been going on for a little bit more than 15 minutes, 20 minutes, and I always try not to talk for more than 15 minutes. I want to reiterate the fact that Russia has already declared war on America. This is something that I've gotten a lot of pushback for. There are various ways in which nations can declare war on other nations. Russia has declared war on America through its cyber attacks. through its interference in our national elections. Now, whether we, it's strategically or through politically, it's whether it's politically expedient for us to identify this as an act of war is up to intelligence, national intelligence, and the governing bodies in our institution. But one can reasonably say that those acts constitute acts of war. And so we're already in a Cold War situation with Russia, and we have every obligation to defeat Russia, either by proxy or by other means necessary. So I wanted to say a little bit more about the importance of the international liberal world order and how America is inextricably linked. America's self-interest is really inextricably linked to the maintenance of that international world order. But perhaps that will come out in the questions. So I'll stop there.
All right. Thank you, Jason. And thanks, Scott, for joining me up here. Thanks to those of you who've raised your hand. First, I just wanted to see, Scott, if you had any questions or reflections. Otherwise, I'll go on.
I do want to ask something about the liberal order, because I do think there is a lot of value to it, but there's also been a type of, us paying for everything and the other countries. I mean, they're starting to since Russia, but, you know, I think that maybe this is a time for us to stand our ground with them a little bit as well and reassessing the value of this order and what everyone's pitching in.
True, that would be a question. That would not be a question of principle. That would be a question of strategy, and that would not be questioning the principle or the rightness or the legitimacy of the liberal world order. That would just be a matter of how it's been allowed to function, or who's paying for what, or who's shouldering the majority of the burden. So that's a question of both expediency and function operations. It's a question of operations, really, and not a question of principle. So I agree with you, Scott, that other countries need to pull their weight a little bit more. I'm not a fan of President Trump, as I think everybody knows, but one of the good things that President Trump did during his administration was to sort of call on the European nations to start paying their fair share and increasing their defense spending. So I agree with you, but that's more an issue of strategy and not an issue of principle. So yeah, you and I would probably agree on that.
Thank you.
But the centrality of the liberal world order, I take to be unassailable good in the world.
Okay, if people aren't speaking, please mute yourself. Okay, and I want to remind everyone, if you're enjoying the conversation, please share it on Clubhouse, share it on Twitter or Facebook. That would be awesome. Clark, always love to see you here.
Thank you, Jag. I appreciate it. I love being here too. But I have to say, I emphatically but respectfully disagree with Professor Hill. There's a lot there, of course, but let me just start with World War II itself. I mean, I was taught in public school last century when I attended that basically Britain appeased and failed to confront the Nazis in 1938, 1939, the Munich, and that year-long run-up to World War II. But when I looked into it not that many years ago, it turns out, you know, the British, like the U.S., they were totally Keynesian statist by the late 1930s, both in domestic policy and internationally in foreign policy. So it wasn't appeasement which led to World War II. If you really dig down into the details, it was the British war guarantee to Poland And I think they also threw one into Romania and some other country that escapes me right now. But that war guarantee, March 31st, 1939, just about 5 months before the Germans invaded Poland, that had a whole lot of bad consequences. The main one being it had the effect of making Nazi Germany and Soviet Russia sign a non-aggression pact. So add that to the list of all the unintended consequences that Keynesian statism produces, which, of course, we can see even, you know, Build Back Better and things today. So the bottom line is, and again, I don't want to go on too long, but the bottom line is really what Ayn Rand said. And of course, she was, she would have been about 35 years old when World War II broke out. She had the right idea. You don't aid either side. You don't pick winners and losers. Let the two bad guys, really bad guys, immoral guys, let them fight it out and basically destroy each other. But the bottom line is, here's my final point. Unlike what I was taught in public school growing up, the Soviet Union won World War II almost single-handedly in both theaters. And I see the Irina is on deck. So thank you, Irina. We don't, here in America, we never acknowledge the fact that it was almost the Soviet Union single-handedly. In fact, it was the groups that are now fighting today in the blood, they called them the Bloodlands. Ukraine, the Belarusians, and the Russians came together to stick it to, I mean, that, really, those are the people we can thank for why Western Europe isn't speaking German today, or at least wasn't, you know, many years after World War II. So it turns out, yeah, Soviet Union almost single-handedly won World War II. They were the bad guys that defeated the other bad guys. And of course, a lot of innocent people died. And you know, obviously the Russian people were fighting to defend their homeland. But it also turns out in the Pacific, you know, I was taught, like many American school children, that the atom bombs ended caused Japan to surrender. That's not true. If you go back and look, the Soviets invaded Manchuria on August 8th, 1945, in between the two bombs of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And the Japanese, you remember, they wanted to keep Hirohito as their emperor. That was the main sticking point. They wanted to keep their emperor. They figured, if you look in the records, if you look in the records, the Japanese figured, wait a minute, the Russians killed their emperor, Nicholas II, 25 years ago. Gee, I wonder what they're going to do to Hirohito. So that's why they surrendered. It wasn't the atomic
bombs.
Well,
let's give Jason a chance to answer.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm not sure what you're disagreeing. Given what I've talked about, I'm not sure. I haven't talked about any. Well, I disagree with your assessment of the Soviets winning the war in Japan, but I'm not sure what the source of your disagreement really is.
We did not have to intervene at all, nor did Britain. The war would have been just between the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany. We should have had open immigration. Had we had open immigration, literally millions of people who ended up dying in the camps would have been able to come to the United States. So
Hitler declared war against us, so we had to intervene. Germany declared war against the U.S., so we had to enter the war.
Well, that was after Lend-Lease and Cash and Carry and all the other programs in that 2 years leading up. And honestly, if you really look at it, the Japanese had three serious peace proposals in 1941. I mean, again,
this is going back 80 years. Let's keep it on Russia a little bit.
Well, again, just to wrap up, I mean, the point is, it's like Russia shouldn't be, we should not be an enemy of Russia.
That's fair, Clark. We appreciate that. Jag, you're still coming out a little bit. In the meantime, we'll go to Irina. Thank you for joining us. Are you able to unmute yourself? Do you have a question for Jason? All right. Well, let's go to TAS founder, Dr. David Kelly. Let's see if you have a question, and we'll come back to Irina.
Okay, thanks, Scott, and thank you, Jason. I have a question about the liberal order. The liberal order is a conceptual framework of laws, expectations, agreements. It's a little more general than an actual alliance structured by treaties. And so I'd be interested in anything more you can say about what makes up the liberal order, and how it should be extended. That is, why we are defending Ukraine against Russia, given granted Russia is an enemy, but there are many things it has done that we're not defending, as in, like Georgia and elsewhere. And there are many bad things that happen in the world by authoritarian powers, and I mean all lots of Western Africa, Somalia, the East Asia, Myanmar, and other countries that we're not involved in. We can sympathize with the victims of all these people, but we're not reaching out to them. So, what is the limiting principle of Jason of defending, or how far does the liberal order extend as a reason for U.S. involvement in trying to increase the scope of possible alliances, or at any rate, bringing people within the liberal order system?
Well, I'll answer the second part first. Somalia and those countries are not enemies of the United States of America. I mean, I don't. We're not in a blatantly adversarial position with them, as we certainly, I take it that we certainly are with Russia. And it's not so much helping Ukraine as it is doing anything in our powers to defeat the Putin regime. And to weaken as much as possible that regime and bring it to its knees and weaken it, destroy the political configuration of the Putin regime. So it's not by any means necessary. If Russia were in a war with France or Russia were in a war with Moldova, I would say we would have the right to not. It's I don't see it so much as that. The way I've framed it is not so much helping Ukraine as it is using Ukraine as a means to defeat Russia. Now the internet, so it's less about defeating, because I know you're going to see this as an act of altruism. It's less about helping Ukraine as it is using Ukraine as a proxy, by means of proxy, to defeat and weaken and destabilize Russia, who has done something quite egregious. And through that egregious act, threatens the civilizational nature of Europe in general. As far as international world order, I mean, it's really meant to prevent the world from becoming an international Europe, basically, or the world, if we extend to the Pacific, from becoming an international jungle. I mean, Acheson said that, with no rules, with no empire, with no prizes for good boys in such a world, weakness and indecision are fatal. So without that kind of order to temper the impulses, the trigger impulses, or the anarchical impulses, or the war impulses, the maniacal impulses of any would-be rogue state or any authoritative, despotic leader or rogue state in the making. We need the liberal world order to keep those nations in check, to keep them at bay, and also to formulate an alliance, to keep the alliance among what I would call the nation of the union of moral states, civilized states, to punish them and to find ways to ostracize, punish, and sanction them when they violate the precepts and the norms that govern the international liberal world order. So it's a regulative means of maintaining or preventing the world from resorting to a Hobbesian state of nature. So the liberal world order was less really about Soviet expansionism and more about preventing the kind of wars that erupted, the two wars that erupted, World War I and World War II, that presented a grave threat to humanity in general, to world civilization. People might differ in their interpretation. I don't know that the world order was when it was created, because Stalin at that time was not yet our enemy, had not become, Russia had not at that time become really our enemy at that time. So it was less about Soviet expansionism and more about preventing the world from becoming some kind of international jungle, from preventing the kinds of decimation that had been created by those two wars. And I think that even more today, where we have the rise of authoritarianism and despotism across the globe, that sort of world order needs to be in place. Given the manifest destinies of Iran, given the manifest destiny of China, which is quite nefarious, and given the manifest destiny of Russia. Well, we don't really have to count North Korea, because that's sort of contained, but they do have nuclear weapons, and they, you know. So that's the answer I would give you, David.
Okay, thanks. I don't want to take too much more of your time, but let me make sure I understand. In saying that the goal is defeating Russia, not so much defending Ukraine. Defending Ukraine is a means to that, to the end of controlling Russia. Some people have argued that Ukraine could be a valuable. It's a fairly civilized country. It wants to join the Western Union, the Economic Union, as well as NATO. The Economic Union is a relevant factor here. So that the positive argument for our involvement in Ukraine is that Ukraine could be a valuable member, could be a great trading partner. It could be part of a security alliance, a defensive one, as you said NATO was. But you seem to be downplaying that. And I just wonder if you give any credibility to the positive argument of let's protect Ukraine as a possible member of an American-led, free world alliance or union of moral nations.
Yes, I would give credence to that argument. I would certainly give credence to it. But my emphasis here is that Russia has declared war on us. It is our enemy. It is our adversary, and we have to use whatever means we can. So the accent for me falls more heavily on defeating, totally weakening and crippling Russia. And if we can use a proxy means to do it, then we should do it. But I wouldn't undermine, bringing into the pantheon of the Union of Civilized States or into the domain of the European Union, a country like Ukraine, which we can, what's the word I'm trying to use? I don't want to use a condescending word, but we can have a civilizing effect on some of these former Soviet states that have been Russified for a long, long time, and bring them within the pantheon of the crucibles of civilizational mores. That is, respect for property rights, freedom of speech, freedom of religious association, everything that's associated with political liberalism in the 16th, 17th century sense of liberalism. You and I wouldn't disagree on that at all. I do think that is a position I would defend. It's just that my first line of defense would be Russia is our enemy, and we should use this as an opportunity, first and foremost, to defeat Russia in whatever way we can.
All right. Bill, thank you. Thank you for your patience. Hopefully you guys can hear me better now.
Much better. When you say by any means necessary, I have noticed that the world order has not, for example, used assassination as a tool against various enemies. It would seem a whole lot of things would happen in our favor if Putin was simply dead. I personally regard that as a moral and least effort answer, if it's doable at all, that is. But what's your opinion?
Well, I think it was President Ford, wasn't it, who sort of did away with the notion of extralegal assassination by executive order. If anybody on the stage can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it was under the presidency of Gerald Ford. I certainly think that in the old days, the CIA would you know, knock off the bad guys. That's a question for national intelligence. I'm not going to answer that. I mean, I certainly.
I meant that as a moral question, not as a practical question.
Well, certainly as a moral question, it would be correct. There would be Putin, just like Hitler, just like Stalin, who killed 32 kulaks, have forfeited their rights, certain rights that they have. So as a moral issue, I would have no problem with it at all. No, as a sort of, is it strategically in our self-interest to make it be publicly known that the United States of America is engaging in extra-legal assassinations? You know, that's something that should never be made public at all. But from a moral perspective, yeah, I would have no moral problems with that at all. None.
I would observe that as we are at war with Russia, perhaps it would be a good point. You declare war on us and, well, we go after you personally. Seems a perfectly good public strategy. Anyway, but that gets a field into strategy, which is really not the point here. So I'll shut up at this point. Next.
Thank you, Bill. Rob, would love your thoughts,
hey,
particularly
there
on some of the historical discussion to see if we've got it right.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
If I could bring up something here, there was a phrase you used early on here that I think needs to be expanded on, or would be helpful to be expanded upon. And that phrase is grand strategy. And I think it's like, I view it as sort of a crucial sort of middle step between political philosophy and foreign policy, this concept of grand strategy. And it is really contrast to the way a lot of people approach foreign policy, which is it's very ad hoc and reactive. And, oh, here's a crisis. What do I think about that? Or more often, what do I feel about it? Whereas I think people need to think more in terms of grand strategy. So I was wondering if you could talk about that a little bit more. Can anybody hear me?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, muted.
Oh, that's okay. I got cut off once on one of these, so I always wonder if I'm going to get cut off again.
So I'm talking about grand strategy in the way that political scientists talk about it, in the sense of a comprehensive, well-integrated philosophy, not in philosophy, but just a well-integrated and comprehensive method of dealing with foreign policy. That is not ad hoc, that is not arbitrary, that is not based solely on necessarily political expediency, but is founded in certain basic fundamental principles that do speak to a country's basic self-interest, broadly construed. Or it may not. I mean, there have been grand strategies that people have argued are inimical to America's self-interest. The fact is that, like any kind of strategy, it's something that is predictable. It's something that will yield certain consequences that one can ostensibly point to. It's something that we can shore up as both expedient, and in some sense, it has a moral upshot to it, an ethical upshot to it. So when political theorists talk about grand strategy in that way, they're talking about a very unified, comprehensive set of policies or doctrines that inform a nation's foreign policy, that is used in a way that is non-arbitrary. As you said, it's in a non-ad hoc sort of manner. And it sort of defines the vision, or how can I put it? Not just the vision, but it defines the um, it defines the tenor and the outlook of a nation's view of itself in the world, in relation to the world. So grand strategy, among other things, I'm thinking, you know, when people like Kagan write about grand strategy, or I'm thinking about his return of history. It definitely speaks to the way in which a country views itself in relation to other nations and its place in the world. And thinking also here of a book that I use quite frequently for my book, which is called American Power and Liberal Order, A Conservative International Grand Strategy by Paul D. Miller. It's interesting that you asked me about that question, Rob, because that book is always on my desk. So when he talks about grand strategy, you know, he's talking about a method by which we can also use to a method of analysis, a methodology by which we can make sense of foreign policy. So it's also prescriptive, right? A grand strategy is also prescriptive. So there's a normative dimension to it. It tells us how we ought to act in the world. Analyses from grand strategy also gives us options for balancing other nations, the way other nations behave in relation to other nations, with other nations. It gives us a strategy. It gives us a methodology for, or a manner of balancing the way nations behave towards other nations. So I would say that the liberal international world order was a sort of it was a part of U.S. grand strategy, but it wasn't solely the grand strategy of the United States. It was shared by our allies. If that helps.
Yeah, I've been crusading for the idea that in addition to the merits of one grand strategy for another, the fact that we should actually, my main view on grand strategy is we should have one, because I think most parties, and I think we haven't really had one since the end of the Cold War. Bush tried to create one during the Iraq War. The Forward Strategy of Freedom was his grand strategy. It didn't take, but we haven't had a really, you know, during the Cold War, the grand strategy was the grand strategy was containment. It was the idea that we're in a contest with the Soviet Union, but our main goal is going to be to contain them and keep them from expanding while we strengthen and grow the free nations.
Right.
And that was something go ahead.
Yeah. Or something like realism versus idealism, broadly speaking, could be a way of framing a grand strategy, assuming that the country adheres to those policies. So you saw where under Bush or quote unquote, little meta grand strategy change right after 9/11, where we got into this notion of we were not the world's 9/11 police, into this notion of nation building. So I don't know if I agree with you that we didn't have I think we didn't have a grand strategy until 9/11, when Bush tried to develop a new grand strategy, which involved a shift from realism into idealism. And that idealism involved, among other things, nation building and spreading democracy and making the world safer democracy, like a Wilsonian grand strategy, right? Something right. like that.
Well, I do want to try to squeeze Roger in with the time we have left. Thank you, Rob. Appreciate that. Roger?
Yeah, hey. Thanks for having me. No, I love getting on this topic, especially with the diversity of thought within the Atlas Society on Russia. My question is more about how do we avoid becoming Russia ourselves? And what I mean specifically is there seems to be people that want to pull us in a more authoritarian direction. And those people, we've called them out for a long time on the left, but there's people on the right that also want to do this. And my question is, how do we avoid authoritarianism coming from either direction? Like what's the sound footing that we could latch onto that would help us avoid going off that cliff?
I don't know. We have a constitution, don't we? And we have a judicial branch of government, and we have a constitution. And I think sometimes I would think there, but for the grace of our constitution, go we. But if that's not a grammatical infelicity, I don't know. Go the rest of us or something like that. But I think that the basic answer is that we have a constitution, and we have three branches of government. And there are restrictions on the kinds of actions that a single individual can take, or there are just ways in which our constitution is configured that something like an oligarchy would be inconceivable in this country. So I think our constitution is our best protection. I see authoritarian impulses on the left and on the right, but not in the way that there is no analogous descriptor here that one could ostensibly point to someone in U.S. politics and say Putin is the, or one could point to Putin and say that's the American analog. Putinism is like the Russian analog of an authoritarian figure in America. I mean, we have a constitution that protects us against all the kinds of transgressions that you see happening in Russia. For example, Putin has just certain powers that allow him to make it possible for him to remain in an office until, if you can call what he occupies an office, but remain in power until 2036. Our constitution just doesn't function that way, that we sort of can give one person that kind of central power to coalesce power and to single-handedly maneuver and navigate oneself in the political realm in such a way that one would harness that much power over an extended period of time. So I think we have this magnificent document called the Constitution that prevents not people from having authoritarian impulses and in sometimes maybe using the privilege of executive orders to behave in an authoritative way, but then there's, you know, the veto powers that we have from certain restraints that Congress can actually exercise to keep those executive powers in check. And what I mean by that is there are certain executive powers that a president might execute, and then we have an election, we vote him out of power, and then a new president comes in and completely overturns that which the previous president had executed. We saw that happening with President Trump, how he just overturned a lot of mandates that President Obama had issued by executive order. So we have a document, Roger, I think that prevents, in my eyes, people might disagree, but I think we have this magnificent document, and the way our the three branches of our government are configured that would prevent something like that from happening. I just can't see it happening. I see it happening culturally, but not politically.
I hope you're right. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
Thank you, Roger. Alan?
Yeah, hi. Jason, as you've said, that the United States is using the Ukraine as a proxy, if that's the correct term. I don't want to misrepresent what you said, but it's using Ukraine as a proxy in order to weaken and overthrow Russia. It seems to me, I can remember back to first, during Jimmy Carter's presidency, and then the outrage from the or the opposition, I don't want to use outrage, the opposition from the left to the U.S. involvement in South America, and then the opposition again from the left for our involvement in Kuwait and Afghanistan and Iraq. And we leave, the United States under Biden says, okay, we've been there long enough, we're leaving, and now we're involved in yet another war. And the justification being that we need to oppose this mortal enemy to the United States, and that we need to oppose this dictator. But it seems to me morally we're using the Ukrainian people, and they're the ones paying the price, not us. And that the way the media has portrayed Putin, I think, is a gross misrepresentation of him. One of the ways, in one case, I mean, his approval rating, despite what Western media says, still remains somewhere in the mid-70s.
All right, well,
so I'm wondering about the moral implication of this and what Ayn Rand would say about it. Because it seems to me contrary, as I think David said, or Clark said, this would be contrary to her position.
I heard somebody say they wanted to chip. Did somebody want to chip in?
Jack, I think you're fading again. Jason, do you want to go ahead and do a quick answer to that question before we wrap up?
Yeah, I didn't say that we're fighting a war by proxy. This is a response to David's question. I said that we would have the right, and we should, if we can, use the Ukraine to fight a war by proxy, because Russia has already declared war on us, and it's just not probably politically expedient for the United States to say, you know, Russia has declared war on us, so we're going to fight a war with Russia. It's just for diplomatic, for all sorts of reasons. So I don't know that that's exactly what the intent of the U.S. government is. I think it ought to be. We are certainly helping the Ukrainians defeat Russia, as morally, and it's in our, I've made a case where I think it's in our self-interest to weaken Russia. But you said something about Russia being misrepresented, Putin being misrepresented. I disagree with that emphatically. I think Putin has made his case very, very clearly. I think it's not just the U.S. media, it's the world media have depicted him in all of his ugliness and his criminality. And yes, he has a lot of popularity in Russia because, and I made this point last week, that the Russian people should pay because they are as nationalistic and as culturally nationalistic as he is. There was a poll that was done by a Russian journalist, if one can trust such polls, but she came out and she said that they are, most of them, after the invasion, his ratings went up because they're just as nationalistic and culturally nationalistic, and they wanted the invasion before the sanctions started to hit, right? So the idea that he's, I don't know where this idea that Putin is misrepresented and that he's some sort of nice guy and that I don't know where the misrepresentation is coming from. There have been all sorts of reports about his behavior and how he functions as a despot and an authoritarian figure. I'm just not buying that at all. I'm flabbergasted. I'm flummoxed, actually, that anyone would see Putin as anything other than he himself has portrayed himself to literally be. And the multiplicity of reports that have come out about how he treats his opponents, how he runs the country, Al Jazeera, from Al Jazeera to BBC, to all sorts of reports, we have, I think, a pretty unbiased and very fair, accurate representation of Putin and how he runs his country and how he deals more specifically with his opponents. So,
Well, great. I mean, we could say a lot more. Go ahead, Jack.
No, just Scott, thank you for being my wingman with all of the connectivity problems I've had today. And I just wanted to thank Professor Jason Hill, thank our founder, David Kelly, thank Rob Trusinski, thank Roger, as always, and thank all of you for all of the great questions. Encourage you to sign up for updates with the Atlas Society so you'll get email notifications on our upcoming Clubhouse sessions. We have one coming up on Tuesday with Rob Trasinski on why we never learn anything from economics, and then Wednesday with Professor Stephen Hicks and Ask Me Anything. So thank you, everyone, and look forward to seeing you next week.